Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, for the first time in state history, New York will cover the cost of all school meals to help address food insecurity and ensure every student can eat for free. That's what Governor Kathy Hochul proposes later today in her State of the State. We'll find out what impact that would have on local food insecurity for students and families when we talk with the Regional Food Bank. Dream on the farm amidst the destruction of the wildfires in L.A., one local creative voice is calling for action, not just to respond to the disaster, but to provoke thought and change around the climate crisis. Tanis Kowalczyk of Farm Arts joins us. From politics to preserves, Silda Wall Spitzer's sweet transition, Brett Berry interviews the former First Lady of New York. On the latest edition of CatsCast, the Catskills podcast, and Maggie Fitzpatrick is here helping us move toward health. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Senate confirmation hearing has opened for Pete Hegseth, President-elect Trump's nominee for defense secretary. The chair of the Armed Services Committee, Mississippi Republican Senator Roger Wicker, says Hegseth, a former Fox News host, is an excellent choice.
This nomination is unconventional. The nominee is unconventional. Just like that New York developer who rode down the escalator in 2015 to announce his candidacy for president.
But ranking committee member Rhode Island Democrat Jack Reed says Hegseth may be the wrong choice because of allegations about his past behavior.
We must acknowledge the concerning public reports against you. A variety of sources, including your own writings, implicate you with disregarding the laws of war, financial mismanagement, racist and sexist remarks about men and women in uniform, alcohol abuse, sexual assault, sexual harassment, and other troubling issues.
Hegseth is waiting to deliver his opening remarks. Forecasters say the Los Angeles area will get powerful new winds today. Fire crews are still working on the Palisades and Eaton fires. Some estimates say the insured losses will be more than $20 billion. NPR's Greg Allen reports that threatens efforts to stabilize California's troubled insurance market.
California recently adopted regulations allowing companies to set higher rates while also requiring them to write more policies in fire-prone areas. Amy Bach with consumer group United Policyholders worries this will set back those efforts.
You know, just psychologically, this disaster couldn't have come at a worse time in terms of insurance executives' renewed confidence in doing business in this state.
Analysts say insurance companies have enough reserves to cover the losses. If the state-created plan that covers many in Palisades and Altadena runs out of money, though, policyholders throughout the state may see a special assessment to make up the shortfall. Greg Allen, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The U.S. Supreme Court says it will not block a lawsuit in Hawaii. It aims to hold fossil fuel companies accountable for damages caused by climate change. NPR's Michael Copley reports dozens of similar cases have been filed against the oil and gas industry.
Honolulu is suing fossil fuel companies in state court for allegedly misleading the public about the dangers their products pose to the Earth's climate. Honolulu says it's suffering as a result from things like flooding and more extreme storms and heat waves. Oil companies argued the emissions causing climate change are a national matter and that lawsuits like Honolulu's belong in federal court. The Supreme Court's decision not to hear the industry's appeal allows Honolulu's case to move forward. An industry group called the American Petroleum Institute said it's disappointed by the decision and that climate change is an issue for Congress to deal with, not the courts. Michael Copley, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 130 points. This is NPR. NPR has learned that negotiators are close to a ceasefire deal for Gaza. The talks are happening in Qatar. A proposed agreement would reportedly see an exchange of Israeli hostages for Palestinian detainees. It would include a 6-week pause in fighting between Israel and Hamas and further talks about the withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza. South Korea's Constitutional Court opened impeachment hearings of President Yoon Suk-yeol today. This is related to his short-lived declaration of martial law last month. But NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Seoul, the hearing was quickly adjourned because Yoon failed to show up.
The hearing lasted for all of 4 minutes before being adjourned until Thursday. If Yoon doesn't attend then, the trial will go ahead without him. Meanwhile, police and investigators met with members of Yoon's security detail ahead of an expected second attempt to arrest Yoon on insurrection charges. Security detail agents blocked a first attempt. Police asked them to cooperate with a second attempt. The security agents didn't promise to do that, but said they would try to avoid a physical clash with police and investigators. Separately, North Korea fired multiple short-range ballistic missiles into the sea, their second launch so far this year. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
A new competitor may try to purchase U.S. Steel. The CEO of U.S. company Cleveland-Cliffs is expressing interest in the storied American company. President Biden has blocked the sale of U.S. Steel to Japanese corporation Nippon Steel. He says it was on grounds of national security. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New York could join a handful of states that make meals free for public school students, regardless of their incomes. A proposal set to be pitched by Governor Kathy Hochul during her State of the State address later this afternoon would require the state to provide breakfast and lunch free for all K through 12 school students. The plan would impact about 2.7 million students and save families about $165 per child in monthly grocery costs. Hochul didn't say how much the plan would cost taxpayers, but previous estimates of universal free lunch have exceeded $250 million. Joining us now to discuss how this proposal could address food insecurity and the impact it could have on students and families locally is Michael Aaron Poindexter, Chief Programming Officer for the Regional Food Bank. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me today.
Of course, the Regional Food Bank has long been involved in addressing food insecurity in New York. What are your thoughts on this proposal to provide free school meals for all K through 12 students in the state?
So this proposal is absolutely game-changing, not just for us as a partner who's fighting food insecurity, but it's game-changing for the families who utilize and will utilize free breakfast and free lunch. The fact that a family can save $165 per month per child is enormous. And no longer will they have to think about stretching their dollars beyond the month or figuring out whether to pay for extracurriculars or just to keep their lights on. And so we celebrate and are encouraging our legislators to support this measure and applaud the governor for proposing this measure. We know that 1 in 9 individuals battle food insecurity. That number increases exponentially to 1 in 7 children and seniors who fight food insecurity. And we know that this proposal will help alleviate hunger, not just in Sullivan County, but throughout the entire state of New York.
Yeah, about 2.7 million students potentially benefiting from this initiative. How do you think that the universal free school lunch meals can directly impact not only food insecurity, but educational outcomes of students in the state?
For sure. So prior to me coming to the food bank, I worked in education for a decade, worked in classrooms and in schools, both primary and secondary. And I saw firsthand what happens when a student shows up and hasn't had a good breakfast or did not receive a hearty, nutritious lunch, and the impacts that it had on them, not only focusing on their academics in the classroom, but what happens when they left the school building and went back to a house that didn't have food in the fridge. And so not only does this fight food insecurity, it ensures that every child will have breakfast and lunch, but it will also ensure that every child has an access point to success to make sure that they don't have to worry about where their next meal is coming from or what's going to happen through the school day, but they'll be able to focus on their academics. And the other piece of working in education, I saw firsthand the stigma that's also associated when students don't have food at home or have to come into a school and don't have and do not have the money or the resources that is necessary to buy breakfast or buy lunch, and what that has on the impact that it has, not just academically, but from a stigma standpoint. And so I am a huge proponent. I've been able to see both sides of the coin, both the education side as well as now with the food bank fighting food insecurity, and what this will do is change lives, and it'll change trajectories because children will be able to focus academically, which will improve their lifelong opportunity for success.
New York already provides free lunch or discounted lunches to a large percentage of students. And this expansion definitely will make a difference. What are some challenges that might arise in implementing it, do you think?
You know, I think it remains to be seen, right? But one thing I do know is that the challenge of food insecurity, the challenge of whether a student will have something to eat, that'll be eradicated. And so I'm sure there are challenges that will be faced on the legislature level, or there's challenges that districts may or may not face from an implementation standpoint. But the bottom line is that food will make it into the stomachs of children who need it the most, that families will not have to struggle and juggle between paying bills that they have or providing food for their kid during the day. And what I know at the food bank is we're doing everything we can to make sure that we're supplementing that. So it takes care of breakfast and it takes care of lunch. But then what happens when that child leaves for the school day and goes back home? And so our hope is that as we continue to support our pantry partners in Sullivan County and all the counties and the 23 county footprint that we serve, that mom or dad will then be able to go to the pantry and receive any supplemental food they need so that they can provide a hearty dinner. And so I'm sure there are challenges that come with any piece of legislation, and there's a dollar tag that comes with anything. But what I know is that the challenge will be eradicated that singularly isolates children from being able to receive the food that they need to be as successful as they can be.
Yeah, there are some estimates that the cost of the program could be $250 million. Is that the message you would have, though, for lawmakers, that there are long-term benefits of addressing food insecurity with this financial investment?
You know, I think anytime you're invested in the children of New York State, the dollar tag, while I'm sure it will be high to some people, what's the other side of the coin, right? If the money is not spent $250 million on this end, then it may cost us $250 million on the back end and lost opportunity and lost success and loss of innovation for these young minds that we're nurturing right now. And so, you know, I am a strong proponent to every legislator who's out there and every community advocate that we should make sure that this comes to pass, that this actually happens so that we can support not just the students of New York State, but these students will eventually become our legislators and become our doctors and our lawyers and our governors and our food bankers. And if we don't make the investment in them now, then what will happen to our state and our country down the line?
If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Michael Aaron Poindexter, the Chief Programming Officer for the Regional Food Bank. We're talking about Governor Kathy Hochul's pitch for universal free school lunches for public school students that she will put forth today in her State of the State address at 1 o'clock. Now, New York is among the states with the highest rates in food insecurity. I think, one in seven families facing food insecurity. Several states, including California and Massachusetts, have already implemented similar free lunch programs. What do you think New York can learn from their experiences, and how do you think the state could possibly improve upon those models?
Well, I think that the state, we're moving in the right direction. Right. We have seen that other states have been able to implement this across the statewide in a statewide scope. And New York will now join the other states that have implemented this. And we're moving in the right direction. I think there are other opportunities as we look for funding for Nourish New York and funding for other programs that the food bank and pantry partners utilize to be able to get more and more food to the individuals who need it the most. And I mentioned Nourish New York because Nourish New York has been a lifeline. You know, it allows a variety of nutritious and locally produced foods to be able to make it to pantry partners, which then makes it to our neighbors in need. And so I think that the governor, not just with this monumental opportunity that we have to service the children of the state of New York, but to service their families and to service every member who's in that 1-to-9 ratio of who's fighting food insecurity, that 1-to-7 for children and seniors to be able to receive the food that they need. And so I applaud the governor and the state of New York and everyone who's working hard to make this legislation happen.
You spoke a little bit about providing meals, providing a way to reduce stigma around that for some folks. Talk a little bit about the broader impact of this initiative on public health or child development, community well-being.
Sure. So it's all connected, right? They're inextricably connected. And we know that when you see it show up, when you see someone show up at a pantry who's in need of food, you also know that there's a high proclivity that there are other needs that they may have, health resources, financial resource challenges. And so what you're basically doing is you're looking at the entirety of the person, but you're addressing one particular symptom, which is at this stage, food insecurity. And so the hope and the goal is by providing a healthy, nutritious meal for the children in our schools within New York State, that we will down the line see some decrease on health challenges as they continue to grow through their adolescence and enter their adult lives and then become seniors, because we've provided the nutrition that they need early on. The hope is that we'll see a decrease in the amount of individuals who are on medicine, or a decrease in the amount of individuals who are visiting our local hospitals, because it starts with taking care of the body. And if we can provide healthy, nutritious meals in all of our students now and start them off on the right trajectory, then hopefully we'll see impacts in other areas of their lives, and not just from a health and a financial resource setting, but also from their ability to focus on their academics and then go and pursue higher education, or go and pursue a trade and then go and live long, healthy, and proactive lives in the state of New York. And so, again, we applaud the governor, but we know that this is going to be game changing, not just for the students currently and their families, but for students for generations to come.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, the next steps in addressing just overall child hunger and poverty in New York State. What do you think is the next step in addressing these challenges? What would you like to see next?
To continue on the pathway we're on. You know, we have my department, we have a goal that all of us will be unemployed one day, that there will be no need for a food bank because there will be no food insecurity. And until we get to that place, then we'll do everything we can to rescue as much food as we can to provide it for our neighbors in need throughout the 23-county footprint that we serve. And we'll continue to do everything that we can as a food bank, not just in the new facility that we're building in the Hudson Valley, so that we can rescue more food, but so that we can continue to advocate for the programs that we know work. We know that Nourish New York works. We know that NIF-NIF works. We know that the other programs that we're beneficiaries of that allow us to rescue more food to get it to the neighbors in need, we know those programs work. But we also know that the truth is that food insecurity is not moving in the right direction. We know that the numbers that we saw just 2 years ago have increased. And while many thought, hey, these are COVID numbers, no, what COVID did was it allowed more people to be truthful with where they were in life. And now we're seeing a dramatic increase in the meal gap and a dramatic increase in the amount of people who are fighting food insecurity. And so this is an opportunity for us to move backwards. It's an opportunity where we must move forward and continue to provide the funding that's necessary for these programs to stay afloat, and the funding necessary so that we can provide the meals and the food that our neighbors in the counties that we serve need. Everyone doesn't come forward and raise their hand because of social stigma and say, hey, I'm battling food insecurity. They may not fill out a form, but they will show up to a pantry. And they will show up to our drive-through distributions, and they will call us here at the food bank and ask how we can, get them the food that they need. And so as a food bank, we're trying to do everything we can to be as innovative as we can to make sure that we're getting food to the very nooks and crannies of the state where food insecurity is the highest, so that our neighbors can receive the food that they need. So to answer your question, we have to continue to move forward. We have to continue to support the governor and support the legislators and advocate for increased funding and advocate for the sustainability of these programs and advocate for the support of our local farmers so that they can produce the wonderful crops that they produce, and we can receive the food that they grow, and then we can in turn get the food as fast as we can to our neighbors in need.
Part of the reason the regional food bank opened that 50,000 square foot distribution center in Montgomery last month was because of this increased demand in food insecurity, because of an increased food insecurity. So I don't think I've ever said this to anyone before, but I hope you're out of a job soon.
Well, it'll mean success. And although I'll probably have to look for another job, I will be happy that my kids will, the four kids that I have, will be able to get free food at school. So I won't have to worry about where I'm going to get my, where they're going to get the money for their meals. So I hope I'm out of a job too, real soon.
In the meantime, Michael Aaron Poindexter, Chief Programming Officer for the Regional Food Bank, helping to combat food insecurity in the Hudson Valley and in New York State. There's more information about their good work at regionalfoodbank.net. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. And a reminder that Governor Kathy Hochul's State of the State address is later this afternoon at 1. You can listen to it live right here on Radio Catskill or stream it at wjffradio.org. When we come back, Tanis Kowalczyk of Farm Arts Collective and the Dream on the Farm 2025 concept and how it relates to the fires in Los Angeles. This is Radio Catskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA, the premiere of our new series, Hombre, Understanding Latino Men. Our first guest is political strategist Chuck Rocha.
There's a lot of Latino men who just don't participate in the process, who feel so left behind, and they work their butts off just trying to give out. Voting is the last thing on their mind.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3, on Radio Catskill.
You are listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As LA endures yet another day of devastating wildfires, many are left grappling with the harsh reality of a climate crisis that seems to be worsening by the day. Amidst the destruction, one local creative voice is calling for action, not just to respond to the disaster, but to provoke thought and change through the power of art and storytelling. Tanis Kowalczyk of Farm Arts Collective is hosting a presentation about their 2025 Dream on the Farm project, which aims to tell stories about how we're interacting with the earth and each other and the need for humanity's reckoning and responsibility for climate change. That presentation is Thursday, and here with the preview is Tanis Kowalczyk. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
Thanks for joining us today. What inspired you to have this presentation to explore the Dream on the Farm concept for 2025? Dream on the Farm, if you can explain to people, is an ongoing initiative about climate change. But in the context of these ongoing fires in Los Angeles and California, what was it that prompted you for this?
Right. So I normally do this to a small group of people with whom I continue to work, the Farm Arts Collective, our collective of people and of artists and scientists and farmers who have committed to making one play every year about climate change. And generally around this time of year, I've come up with the next year's idea with, the 2025 idea. I've come up with it, and I generally will just present it to my troupe. But I thought this year, there's a couple things going through my mind. One is I really would love to get more of the community engaged in this project and in this topic for the sake of the art itself and for the sake of the just bringing in new blood and new creativity into the ensemble and the collective. But also, I'm feeling like we as a community, in the face of climate change and in the face of this socio-political world that is all around us, that we as a community actually need to take on projects like this together, and we need to strengthen our collective voice. And so I think that's the reason. Like, I am kind of asking myself the same thing, honestly, Tim. Like, why am I doing this? Like, it's really a vulnerable thing to tell people publicly what you're thinking of for your next play before you've written it or before you've made it with your, you know, with your ensemble. But it's just this gut feeling I have that this is something that I need to do in this moment.
Well, as you mentioned, you would normally kind of maybe come up with this concept for the next Dream on the Farm by yourself or with a small group of folks that you collaborate with. But do you feel that maybe part of this is because you're tapping into maybe a general anxiety that's going on right now, not only just with what's going on geopolitically, but just if you address the climate change in the context of the LA fires? I mean, we all kind of watch this and think, oh my gosh, we are all sort of helpless here. What can we do? And you hear that from folks on the ground in California as well.
Yeah, no, it's exactly right. You've said it better than I did. And it's so true. Tapping into the angst, the cultural angst and like the question of, gosh, we all do need to do something and let's talk about it. And then let's come up with a plan, and make a performance and make an action and make have a community conversation about it over the course of the next, you know, 8 months that we'll be working on this project, here at Will-O-Wisp.
You mentioned that this is a conversation starter. You're not sure what we're doing here, but you're putting it out to the community, which is great. No commitments asked of attendees for the January 16th event. But what do you hope to ignite in the minds of those who come?
Well, I would like to ignite, ignite a conversation that evening, to both like kind of advance and progress my ideas for this show, which is based on Milton's, let's say inspired by Milton's Paradise Lost, but it's called Paradise Lost Scavenger Hunt. So I have this, I'm going to present this concept I have for beginning a performance with the whole theme of humanity's creation and the world creation and then the fall after eating the from the tree of knowledge and the expulsion out of paradise into the world. And then our scavenger hunt starts, you know. And so I'm going to present this general idea, and then see what it ignites in people's imaginations and minds and hear from them. And the best way to get people engaged is by asking what they think and what they see in their imaginations, and then see if this project can grow into a really exciting collective of artists and scientists and thinkers and philosophers from within our community, makers, builders, like whoever's going to show up. I have no idea. But let's dream together. You know, we're dreaming together right now on this project.
How does the format of an interactive scavenger hunt help convey the urgency of the climate crisis?
I think that this scavenger hunt that we're going to ask the actors and the audience to go on is a kind of metaphor for the discovery and the confrontation that we all have to have with our own actions in the world. Like, so you're going to Italy again this winter, Tanis, you know, and you're doing your play about climate change. Like, you know, we have to confront these things. And then we have to come up with like signs and solutions and look for ways of moving forward. And it's a hunt. It's a search. Like, I want to literally embody this search for solution and search for having those ding moments where you're like, ah, right, I see something. And when we go to these stations on the farm that are going to be either performative or an art installation or a scientific presentation, because I'm really opening up to the community and to the collective, like, what can we do on the scavenger hunt? What can people find as they move around the farm? You know, I feel like it's a metaphor for what we have to be doing as a global community, let alone a regional community. Keep searching and looking for solutions together.
And is that how you view the role of artists and artisans in reckoning with these realities?
Yeah, I mean, we have to be the leaders and we have to really be creative and be truthful and honest and keep looking for ways of talking about it in an inclusive way, but also in an honest, like no BS way. Like, let's just say what's going on and let's try to figure it out together.
And again, Dream on the Farm is that decade-long cycle of your climate change-themed plays at Farm Arts Collective. Yeah. You have that presentation coming up Thursday at 6 at the Farm Arts Collective Agricultural Center. Anything you want to say before we go about this pretty big subject, but maybe talk to those who are maybe feeling the same anxiety or maybe even unsure about how they can contribute to tackling such a large issue.
Right. I think that certainly just, you know, joining us for this conversation is I don't think you need to commit to anything, but just to join a conversation and to be in the room with some people who are thinking about these things, thinking about our future, thinking about our land, thinking about our relationship to the world and how we are moving through it and how our actions affect what the earth is going through and what we are ultimately going through. I think just like coming and being a part of the conversation is going to lead to something, you know, and it is an act in itself. And I hope people feel welcome. Anyone is welcome to come to this event on Thursday. Going to have soup and a really welcoming environment for people to listen to my proposal and then to just simply have a really rambling conversation together.
Well, be a part of the community coming together to try to just at least talk about it. Yeah. Plus soup. Farm Arts Collective Artistic Director Tanis Kowalczyk, her presentation of the 2025 Dream on the Farm concept and plan of action is this Thursday, January 16th at 6 at Farm Arts Collective Agricultural Center. That's in Damascus, Pennsylvania. There's more information at farmartscollective.org. Tanis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, Maggie Fitzpatrick from the Sullivan County Democrat and her latest column, Moving Toward Health, in which she tells us that even though it's okay to use a little external motivation to get you moving, don't expect it to last forever. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This is Jeff Loeffler. Join me each and every Friday, 10 to midnight, as we go deep, playing songs that you don't hear on the radio all the time. It's the Deep End.
Deep End.
Deep
End.
Deep cuts and live tracks from the worlds of classics, psych, prog, jam, and blues rock. The Deep End, each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight, right here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Maggie Fitzpatrick is the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat. Her column is out every Tuesday called Moving Toward Health, and she joins us now to talk a little bit about it. Hello.
Hi.
You share some thoughts in this column that you used to dislike fitness challenges.
I definitely did.
Tell us some more about your initial thoughts about these challenges and what changed your mind over time.
Okay, so a fitness challenge, I guess we should probably just describe what that is at first.
I'm just going to say with those two words, I hate it already.
Yeah.
Fitness challenge. Okay, now go ahead.
Okay, so the idea is that you are committing to goals for a short period of time. Okay, so this could look like as short as 3 days, 5 days a week. It could be a month. It could be, you know, 3 months, something like that. But it's generally shorter than 3 months time period would be considered a fitness challenge. And the thing is that it usually takes more than 3 months to actually build a habit and or see changes from the new habits that we are putting into place. And so I used to really not like fitness challenges because I would say, well, we're not giving ourselves enough time to even see any results anyway. So, you know, kind of like, what's the point? that was really my mindset around it.
When you talk about how challenges can be beneficial for jump starting, you know, habits that have been ingrained, but you also say they're not a one size fits all solution. So how do you suggest people approach this?
Yeah. So the way that they can really be beneficial, like you said, is they can be a form of external motivation. And I like that word jumpstart. They can kind of jumpstart this process or this snowball effect, right? And you say, okay, I'm going to commit to do these things for a short period of time. It doesn't feel very overwhelming to commit to this short period of time. I can do that. And then eventually you start, you know, doing your habits. You drink your water, you do your workouts, all those things. And then hopefully the idea is that then you have some momentum so you can continue doing those things after the time frame of the challenge. And I think if we use them that way and expect that it's just the beginning of something that needs to last longer, then they can be really beneficial. But the problem can arise when we think that a short-term challenge is going to solve all of our problems.
What do you think are some of the differences between using one of these challenges that ignites some temporary momentum versus using it to create this like long-term sustainable habit?
I think one of the biggest things is that we can train ourselves to rely on motivation and validation from external sources, right? And so when you're constantly committing to doing a challenge of things that someone else is telling you to do, someone else is creating the framework for it, the time frame, they're giving you praise, right? We can kind of get addicted to that in a sense, right? And then it creates this all or nothing where I'm really good when I'm in a challenge and then I'm really off when I'm not. And we all go through different periods of experiencing that type of situation with all different things in life. You know, we're not always great at consistency right from the beginning. That's kind of the whole thing, right? But we want to move towards consistency. We want to move towards not relying on a source of external motivation all of the time to do the things that we need to do, especially because that external motivation is going to, it's going to go away. We're not going to get the same effects from it as we would in the beginning. I don't know if you heard this, but I was doing a little bit of research around this topic and then the topic that I'm going to write about next week. And this past Friday is coined like Quitter's Day. Oh, it's the second Friday of January is usually when you see the biggest drop off in resolutions and things like that. And so that's about that period, that 2 week period of where this external motivation is going to power you through and then it's gone. Right. Yeah, so we don't want to rely on that.
Well, we talk a lot about this idea here that the health journey is not always linear. There's always going to be some setbacks along the way and experiencing these ups and downs. How do you think that someone, can identify some challenges that are realistic and then align with their goals then?
Oh, that's a really great question. I think it's important to figure out what is important to you right now, right? Because we can't focus on everything at once. If we could, that would be kind of nice, you know, that we could just like get everything into shape all at one time, but that's not really how it works. So it's important to figure out what is most important to you. Is it movement? Is it food? Is it you sleep? You know, whatever that is, make sure that the actual tasks are aligned with the goals that you want to achieve. It seems simple, but it's really easy to get overwhelmed with, I need to do this, and do all the things. And then we haven't actually made real progress towards our most important goal, like what's most important to us at the time. So I think it's important to figure out what that is for you and then look at the tasks of the challenge and see, do those actually move me closer to making progress? The other thing I would look at is just the energy of the person that's hosting it, right? Yeah. And some people are really intense and they kind of use this like, I don't want to say punishment mentality, but it's a little bit on that side, right? It's like, you better do this or else. And some people really respond well to that and some people don't. And so you want to make sure that the energy around the challenge, the way that the person is going to be pushing you is actually a way that you feel motivated and not the opposite. Because if it doesn't align, then you're going to move farther away.
Do you have an example of a fitness challenge that someone might incorporate into their regular fitness routine that kind of helps out a little bit? I mean, not that someone has to do exactly this, but this is sort of an example so people understand a little more.
I think there are so many examples. You can find them all over the internet.
Just ask your good friend Google.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I used to host one called the Move More Challenge. I'm not hosting it right now. Like, I don't have it to promote. Maybe one day in the future I'll do it again. But basically what it was a 30-day challenge where you received workouts from me, like your strength training for the week. I think it was like 4 strength training workouts per week. But the challenge component really came down to taking a walk outside every day. Drinking half your body weight in fluid ounces of water every day. And I think the other component of it was eating vegetables with every meal. So those are the things that I decided to put into the challenge to help people move towards like this overall wellness goal.
But it was incorporated into the regular health routine or healthier habits as well.
Exactly.
And I guess it just goes to prove the point that like it's not the long-term thing, it's a short-term sort of thing because you're not doing it anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the beauty of a challenge is that you commit to it for a short period of time, but it's not sustainable forever. It's not something that you can commit to for the rest of your life.
All right. Moving toward health is the column Maggie Fitzpatrick has in the Sullivan County Democrat every Tuesday. You can find it on newsstands now or at scdemocratonline.com. And let's just encourage people not to quit on Quitter's Day, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, if you already made it to today with your New Year's goals, then you made it past Quitter's Day.
Just a few more days.
Exactly.
All right. Maggie Fitzpatrick, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. We'll take a break. And when we come back, the latest edition of Cat's Cast, the Catskills podcast with Brett Berry. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Say, if you're tired of the cold outside, join us inside for the annual Retro Cocktail Hour All Exotica show, where we'll sweep you away to a tropical climate with tunes by the new Les Baxter Orchestra, the Waitiki Seven, the Islanders, and more. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music is always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul will deliver her third State of the State address this afternoon, laying out her vision for the year ahead. Join Radio Catskill for live, special coverage from the New York Public News Network starting at 1, hosted by Dave Lombardo with analysis from Ian Pickus and Chantel Smith before and after the address. It's the 2025 State of the State address this afternoon at 1. On Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
This is Kusar Grace KG, right here in the place to be, WJFF Radio Catskill Music Emporium, Tuesday night, 7 to 9. 2 hours of great music, jazz, funk, blues. I got mellow grooves to help you unwind, exciting rhythms to help you cut loose. Join me Tuesday night for the Music Emporium, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, in the latest edition of Cat's Cast, the Catskills podcast, host and producer Brett Berry speaks to the former First Lady of New York, Sylda Wall Spitzer. From politics to preserve, she's had a sweet transition, and she's now making jams, and she talks to him in this episode about her memories of jam making and how that journey began, her experiences as the former First Lady of New York, and her ongoing passion for sustainability and community service. Here's Brett.
It's not every day a First Lady invites you for lunch. But that's exactly what happened when Sylda Wall Spitzer welcomed me to her Hudson Valley home for a gourmet sandwich featuring her very own line of jams. I spoke to Sylda about those jams, of course, plus the privileges and, well, perils of her tenure as New York's First Lady. We started at the stovetop in her Hudson Valley home.
I'm Sylda Wall Spitzer, and I have been coming to the Hudson Valley for over 30 years now. So I have the blessing of being able to share life between New York City and Columbia County, Dutchess County, and then going over to the other side of the river and the Catskills.
You grew up in North Carolina.
I did.
And that's where you kind of got started with jam with your parents and grandparents.
Well, I certainly grew up with that all around me. And I feel a little guilty trying to take any credit for that at all because I was young. And a lot of it was just watching them do it. And probably wanting to go outside and play. When I first started coming up to the Hudson Valley, we had a big orchard, and they had a lot of peach trees. And my parents came up to visit one summer, and peach trees don't necessarily produce great quantities of fruit every year. This particular year, they had just like falling off the trees fruit. And my parents looked at it and said, you know, what are you doing with all of this fruit? You can't just let it go to waste. We're good coming out of that Depression era family. You waste nothing. And so I was like, well, I don't know. And my dad said, well, you could make some jam, some preserves. And I was like, well, I have no idea how to do that. And so he said, oh, it's easy. So we went to the store, we got the jars, we got some pectin, got some sugar, got some lemons. I came back home and he and my mom showed me how to make jam. And so that was my first experience actually cooking the jam. And we had made like 70 jars, and we're like, well, what am I going to do with all this, all the jam? And so began to give holiday gifts to friends, and we loved doing it. The girls loved getting involved. And so one year I gave some jam to Amanda DiRobello, who was the chief of operations for New York Makers, which was a digital magazine and marketplace that I had started for the state. We were looking at ways to try to increase our margins. The digital business is tough, if you ask anyone who's there. She had this jam, and she said, oh my goodness, this is so delicious. We have to make the jam. And because it was all about New York Makers and we're makers at heart, we thought that would be perfect. And so that's how we got started in the jam making for Silda's Jam.
Is Silda a family name?
It is. It is a made up name.
Oh.
And I usually just say, I'm from the South and my mother's name is Trilby. And people go, I understand. So there's kind of an odder story behind that, that my mom, she had this theory, I'm the oldest, that if you name your child something that is different, but not so different that people would make fun of it, that it would give you a leg up in life.
I mean, she was right.
I think the jury is still out. But
can we talk about some of the great things?
Sure.
The Silda's Jam story points right to your tenure as former First Lady of New York.
Yes.
Very cool.
Yes. That was a real privilege.
At this point in our conversation, I had to ask the question that I suspected listeners would be waiting for. In light of Silda's warm welcome, and currently grilling me a sandwich, no less, it wasn't a question I was eager to ask. I'm going to touch on something quickly.
Okay.
The First Lady / Spitzer combination does come with some baggage.
Uh-huh.
And many listeners will associate that with the governor's scandal and ultimately a traumatic implosion. How are you able to balance all the good things that came with uh-huh. that position with the shadow?
Well, what I would say is that in everyone's life, you have things come up that are certainly not expected, that are difficult and challenging. And I think what's important is how you respond to that. And so for me, I did feel like it was a real honor and privilege to be able to serve as First Lady. I love the state. And so I've also always believed that you can serve. My background is always about serving, being part of community. And so for me, it's a question of you can do it in the private sector, you can do it in the public sector, you can do it in the nonprofit sector. And so it just depends where you are, what's available to you to be able to use it for the goals that you want to.
Silda's dogs, Sam and Tuck, were as uncomfortable with my question as I was. But Silda graciously put them out on the porch, and she continued.
Go. And obviously I wish that it had lasted longer because I feel like we were doing a lot of good work, and I was trying to do everything that I could to support the administration, especially around green energy, sustainability, keeping the next generation in New York to help with the economic future for our state. So all of those things that we were working on were very exciting. And when faced with a situation where your world changes all of a sudden, that doesn't mean that what's important to you and what you're working towards has to change, but the way that you approach it can change. And so before I was First Lady, I was running a not-for-profit that I had started that was about engaging young people in volunteering and service from an early age. Other things that I was doing in the official capacity, I had been doing privately before. And so continuing after that, I just did a sort of a strategic plan around what was important to me, what I wanted to keep working on, and then how could I move that forward most effectively with the avenues that were available.
One more First Lady question for you, and we'll move on. What do you think the public ought to know about First Ladies and First Gentlemen? Is it luxurious? Is it stressful? Is it surreal? I mean, you're in the same club as Eleanor Roosevelt.
It's a... Well, that is a true honor for me. It is a strange role because it is not elected in and of itself. And yet you are very much expected to serve and to be a presence. And so it's just a fascinating kind of unique position, I think. And so I'm loving that they're now first gentlemen who are having to navigate that as well as first ladies.
You know, I looked up First Ladies of New York and Wikipedia, and it comes up First Ladies and First Gentlemen. We have our first gentleman.
We do have our first.
And I don't mean to take you away from whatever you want to do here.
It's just your lunch.
Then I definitely don't want to take you away from it. Let's talk a little bit about your other career, careers outside of Albany: corporate law, mergers and acquisitions, corporate finance, private equity firms, and the list goes on. Plus, you're called on to speak about environmental sustainability, entrepreneurship, financial literacy, women's leadership. Where does that drive come from? Maybe it goes back to the name Silda. And is there some thread or consistency in your goals?
I really think the thread or consistency is about community, sustainability, service, giving back, because I feel like that's where my purpose lies, and I feel like that's where each of us can find our purpose. There is no moment, or no person, I should say, for whom there's not something they can't do for someone else, and there is no person who doesn't need the help of someone else to live their life. And so I think that is the great commonality that we all share. And when we stay focused on that, a lot of the divisiveness can go away, because we realize first and foremost what's most important is looking out for each other and being there for each other.
Okay, so why JAM?
Well, JAM kind of brings it all together in a way, because it's making. So for me, the active voice is very important. As you say, you know, being driven to do things, we can't wait for someone else to do things for us. I was brought up where we had to look out for ourselves and we had to do for ourselves. And so there was hardly ever a moment where someone wasn't moving, doing, making. It was the way my family lived. And so that's in my DNA. And so that's why I'm so active and moving forward and always wanting to look for, how can I help? How can I achieve what it is that I want? I'm not waiting for someone else to do it.
And true to your entrepreneurial spirit, you've innovated JAM itself, I hear, replacing granulated sugar with New York State maple syrup and updating the recipe with natural fruit pectin. Can you explain what both of those things mean?
Yes. So what the pectin is it helps the JAM kind of thicken and hold together. And so I was also using another a kind of pectin that was, it was a citrus based at the time. We're using kind of a more broad fruit based now. The all fruit pectin is a little bit more firm. So that comes from apples and other different kinds of fruit. So that's been interesting that the taste is pretty much the same. The maple syrup came from loving maple syrup, having maple syrup be so identified with New York as a product, and it's delicious. And so I just tried that one time because I just wanted to see what it would taste like. And we really liked the, it's got a nice sort of after flavor. It just felt a little bit more rich from a taste point of view. And so started incorporating that and used that. I would say it's not the most cost effective because if you compare 5 pounds of sugar with the equivalent amount of maple syrup, they're very different price points, but it's been worth it to us to bring that experience.
So give me a sense of the team now.
We've been working with a co-packer that's here in Columbia County. We have a distributor that we're working with. I love this. We're working with the Columbia County CoArc, and they're doing our distribution.
For people who don't know, CoArc is people with disabilities?
Yes, it's to help people with special needs mm-hmm. and find jobs for folks with disabilities as well and provide other services. It's a really, really fabulous organization. They put the string and the spoon on the jars, and that makes it such a nice gift. So we love being able to do that. And then they ship out. So we work with them on doing all of that distribution, and they've been fantastic.
So from a business perspective, are you close to taking on Smucker's, or do you have other aspirations for Silda's Jam?
I want people to try it, and I want people to love it. Most of our retailers are here in the Hudson Valley, but we are actually starting to get folks who are reaching out from other places to carry it, and that's thrilling. And we think it makes a great gift. So people can order it online and be able to give it that way. So we're smaller, would like to keep growing, but I think Smucker's is safe for as long as they want to be there, because I think our audience is a little different. Mm-hmm. They're looking for some more unusual flavors. They appreciate the maple syrup. And so it's more of a gourmet item, I would think. And so we like being able just to make people happy, and that's how I think we can do it the best.
You can find more information at sildasjam.com. For CatsCast and WJFF Radio Catskill, this is Brett Berry.
And thanks to Brett for that. He was speaking to former First Lady of New York, Silda Wall Spitzer. And you can find that episode and more episodes of Cats Cast, the biweekly series featuring Catskills culture, history, local interviews, the arts, and more at catscast.com. And all the shows are hosted by Brett and produced at Silver Hollow Audio in the heart of the Catskills. And they've been voted best regional podcast 3 years in a row. And you can hear why. That will do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A program note, Governor Kathy Hochul's State of the State Address is later this afternoon at 1. You can listen to it live here on Radio Catskill or stream it at wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York. A newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjayville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
On the next Radiolab...
Should we just go now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
A sort of...
giving consent for this procedure.
I am
right?
giving consent.
Organ...
Here comes the big needle.
...inside the human body that scientists had...
Whoa.
There it is.
...completely missed.
So is that it? Are we looking at it right now?
That's it.
Even though it had always been sitting there in plain sight inside of all of us. That's on the next Radiolab. Wednesday at 1 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, windy with some afternoon snow showers, high 21. Tonight, some snow showers with accumulation possible around an inch, a low tonight 13. The cold continues tomorrow. Some snow showers possible, high 21. Tomorrow night's low 14, maybe some evening flurries. Warming up maybe to 30 on Friday with some sunshine.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.